Cruella, isn't that a new fur coat?
My only true love, darling. I live for furs. I worship furs. After all, is there a woman in all this wretched world who doesn't?
Clothes.
Treat yourself.
Fragrances.
Treat yourself.
Massages.
Treat yourself.
Mimosas.
Treat yourself.
Fine leather goods.
Treat yourself.
There is more money here than we could spend in 10 lifetimes.
Please tell me. How much is enough? How big does this pile have to be?
So we are in a short series going through the Gospel of Luke about what Jesus has to say about our finances. And before I jump in, since I'm going to be unable to do the sending, and this is where I would normally do it today, I heard this past week about the officer shooting that happened in the city of Little Rock between an officer and a black man named Bradley Blackshire. I'm sure a lot of y'all have heard about this. I just want to take a moment. I know it's a complicated world that we live in, and there's a lot of different narratives going on, but I will tell you this one thing that everybody here knows. The Blackshire family is grieving, and one of the main reasons that I felt this call back to Little Rock was because of the history of our city and the call that God has on the Church of Jesus Christ to be an agent of racial reconciliation. And so, I would like to invite us all to take a moment of silence as we pray for the Blackshire family. Would you bow your heads with me? God, there are things that only you can do in this world. We live in a fractured, broken world that seems to be getting more and more broken and separated and torn apart at the seams every day. God, whatever work you can do in our own hearts, whatever work you can do in our own city, would you use us as ambassadors of the gospel of Jesus Christ, a gospel that brings reconciliation, not division, a gospel that brings people together from every tribe and every tongue. May we be your healing force in this world and for this city. We now ask for your peace to be with the Blackshire family, and may this church be an avenue of reconciliation for the city of Little Rock. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
So, about 10 years ago, Leslie and I had just had our first kid, Eden, and times were tight. We didn't have a lot of money, and I'd just gone and spoken at something, and I'd been given an honorarium, which was great because we needed it. And after about a few days, I had some bills to pay, so we needed to cash that or put that honorarium in the bank, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So ultimately, it dawned on me, I probably threw that thing away when I was throwing away my old sermon notes from that time that I was going to, the thing I was going to speak at. So I started going through all of our trash, like from the past week. And because we had recently had a baby, the dynamics of our trash had changed very much. It was very disturbing. I mean, I was going through used diapers, you know, mushed baby food that was uneaten. It was gross. And I spent hours going through looking for that check. And I never found it. Because Leslie had deposited it earlier that week. So we're in this short series talking about money and what Jesus has to say about in the Gospel of Luke. And the reason I tell you that story is because money can make us do things we would never do otherwise. It's why we ask dumb questions like, how much would it take for you to, you know? There's a price tag to us doing bizarre, crazy, sometimes even sinful things. And Jesus knows that money has the ability to trick us. He calls it the deceitfulness to wealth. And so He wants us to not let money have a hold of us. He doesn't want to get our money. He wants to make sure our money doesn't get us. And that's why I like the way Jesus ended the passage that we talked about last week. He says, so therefore, be rich towards God. But how do you do that? Who do you write that check to? I mean, do you write that check to God? And maybe you're like me. Maybe it bothers something inside you whenever you hear somebody like me stand up and talk about giving money to church. It doesn't sit well with you. I get that. It bothers me too often because I've seen religious leaders, people like me, abuse this topic to get, you know, a bigger salary or a nice plane for themselves or use God's name to get ahead. But I'm going to talk a lot about money as your preacher because our culture desperately needs a fresh word about money, about how to keep the stuff that we own become stuff that owns us. And so if you are a guest here this morning, I'd like to ask for 30 minutes, you give me the benefit of the doubt. I am not talking about money so I can furnish my home in the Hamptons. I am talking about money because Jesus talked a lot about money and has to teach us some things we desperately need to hear. So all throughout Luke's gospel, Jesus is crystal clear on the fact that what you do with your money says a lot about what you believe. Luke's gospel talks more about money than any other book in the New Testament because Jesus knows the seduction money has for us to be a functional God. We say in God we trust on our money, but then we use it in ways that don't exactly display that it's God we trust. And today we get to a couple of stories in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus says some of the most bizarre, disturbing, and complicated things about our money. Again, not because Jesus wants to get your money, but because Jesus wants to make sure your money doesn't get you. So here's this first story. In Luke chapter 16, starting in verse 1, here's what Jesus says. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors, and he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He said, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than with the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it's gone, and it will one day be gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. So Jesus wants you to be like the dishonest manager. Some of you are here today and you're thinking, I'm better at following Jesus than I thought I was. What is Jesus saying here, right? What is this about? A couple of observations. One, Jewish people were not supposed to loan money at interest. They weren't supposed to do usury. And so they, like religious people tended to do, they found a workaround, a loophole, where they could obey the letter of the law and ignore the spirit of the law. We've evolved past that, I know, but imagine being like this. A religious person who knows what God really wants for you, but figures out a way to get around with using some kind of legalism. So this is what they did. They wouldn't loan money, because God says not to do that. They would loan stuff, and they would charge interest on that stuff. They would charge interest in kind. So they would not loan money, they would loan grain or oil. They weren't breaking the law, but they weren't keeping it either. And when this dishonest manager realizes he's going to lose his job, he has this kind of existential crisis, and he says one of my favorite verses in the Bible personally. where he says, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'd be too ashamed to beg. As a preacher, I totally relate to this. Like, I've got these delicate book-reading hands. What else am I going to do with my life? I love that the guy says this. And so the steward comes up with a plan, and he decides to start obeying the spirit of the law with his master's possessions. So he goes to all the people who own money, who owe the guy possessions like oil and grain, and he says, tell you what, why don't you take that interest right off? Just pay me back exactly what it is you owe me. You know why? Because all of a sudden he realized what every single person in this room needs to realize. His time is short. It's going to run out. And so he has in this limited window an opportunity to do something with the stuff that he has a little bit of say over that will leverage him for a better relationships in the future. And yeah, it's a bit shady, but he realizes all of a sudden the clock is ticking on the things he has stewardship over. The point of Jesus' story is not that you should be dishonest. The point of Jesus' story is the guy is finally aware of something he should have been aware of all along, which is it's not his stuff. It never belonged to him. He was a steward for his master's possession, and he should have been using his position and resources not just for himself, but for others as well. Which is why Jesus follows up this story with these verses in verse 10. Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with very much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with very much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? I love that line. Jesus looks out over all the people that own all these different things and he says, look, you think that's rich? Wait till you see what God has. Wait till you see what God has in store for you. Listen, I'm talking to a lot of rich people. I'm a rich person talking to a lot of rich people. We are people with means and resources, and Jesus has something to say to us, and it's deeper, way deeper than just give more money to church. It's how do you view what you've got? How do you view what you've got? Do you think it's all yours? Do you think you came by it through your hard, industrious work ethic? That may be true. You may have a great work ethic. You may wake up early and you may leave the office late. You may have put in the time. You may have pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps. But let me caution you. Jesus wants to caution you. That's a great way to be entitled and unhappy. And it's honestly just not the whole truth, is it? Because think about what God has done for you. Think about what you do get to steward. Yeah, you went to medical school. Yeah, you went off to that great college other people couldn't get into. Yeah, you're smart. Yeah, you've done the hard work. Yeah, you've got where you've gotten. A large part of it is because you've worked real hard. Yeah, I get that. I will grant you that. But did you get to pick when you were born? Did you get to pick what family you would be born into? Did you get to pick where you would be born? Let me tell you. You think you're successful because of the hard work that you have put into it. And granted, there's a small piece of that. But if you were born in a yurt in Outer Mongolia, you would not enjoy the level of success you have today. And we don't ever step back to think about that. The time and places, the book of Acts is later going to tell us, God has ordained the times and places that we would live. You are a steward of so much. You didn't get to choose your life. It is a gift from God. And what you do with it, granted, that's a gift from God. That's your gift to God back. But unless we have regular habits of generosity, we will forget how much we have already been given and how it all is God's. This whole thing is God's. God was here before us. God will be here after us. And you don't need to feel guilty about the things that you own or the gifts God has given you. You don't need to feel guilty. You need to feel grateful for that. You have been given certain talents and blessings from God, but they are not yours alone. And they're not going to last forever. And what you're called to do right now is be a good steward of the things that you have. Your possessions, they don't really belong to you. They came from God for God's purposes. And here's why Jesus wants you to know that. If you miss out on that, You will miss out on real joy and real riches. But it's not just that. Your soul is in danger. Look, I know church people. When we talk about our soul being in danger, we tend to talk about doctrine. And of course, you want to try to get a doctrine that is true to the Scriptures, true to the nature of God. But when Jesus talks about your soul being in danger, you want to know what He talks about more than anything else? Our wallets, our purses, our bank accounts. Because they are lying to us. Which is why the very next story is one of the hardest stories, and it's right in the heart of the Gospel of Luke. It's Luke 16, starting in verse 19. Or actually, we're going to start in verse 13. Jesus says, "No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other. He will be devoted to one and despise the other." So who are you talking about, Jesus? What master are you talking about? And then he makes it crystal clear. You cannot serve both God. Let's say it all together. You cannot serve both God. Can you believe he says money? Wouldn't you expect him to say God and sin? You can't serve God and the devil. But Jesus, who's really clear on this, says you cannot serve both God and money. He lasers in on this one thing. And it is the thing that most of us in this room are tempted to think Jesus doesn't even care that much about. Right? I mean, how many of us pray before we make a major purchase? Before we upgrade the phone or buy that car or, you know, that house. I'm not saying this to make you feel guilty. I really am not. I'm saying this because Jesus is crystal clear on this. Money is not a neutral commodity. It's not. It is something that it's a spiritual power fighting for your soul. Jesus is really clear. You cannot serve both God and money. And yet we just pretend like that's not what he's talking about. And here's the thing. Our relationship, I think Jesus is trying to say, and this is how blunt he is, I think Jesus is trying to say your relationship with your money can tell you more about your relationship with God than almost anything else in your life. Maybe that's why I don't like it when preachers talk about money. It's not because televangelists are greedy. They are, but it's not just because of that. It's not just because we've seen church leaders abuse church people's generosity or financial scandals that have made the news. That's happened, but it's not just because of that. It's because money is a spiritual principality and power, and it's fighting for my soul and yours. And it's not hard to tell how we're doing in life. You know, on almost anything else I could preach, you would not know exactly where you stand. I could say, guys, let's just go out and pray more. And you could be like, yeah, let's do that. Or guys, let's go home and let's be more spiritual. Yeah, let's do that. Guys, let's make God more of a priority. Yeah. But this is so practical. I mean, you can look at your bank account and know how you're doing with this. And that's why Luke tells us the Pharisees don't like what Jesus is saying. Because they, Luke tells us, right after he tells us, you cannot love both God and money, you will hate one and love the other. Right after he tells us that, he says, and the Pharisees loved money. Which means they hate God. And they won't know that, of course, until they wind up killing him. And neither will we. Because the Pharisees thought they were these godly, righteous people. Why? Because Luke tells us they justified themselves in their own eyes. They could love money, but you thought highly of them. They could love money, but they were doing things the right way. You are the one, Jesus said to them, you are the ones who justify yourself in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. Past all the ways you're good at being religious, past all the ways you know how to dress right for church, pray the breathy prayers, do the right things for church, God knows your heart and God isn't fooled. But look at what he says. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight. They justify themselves in their own eyes and the eyes of others. Does that sound familiar to anybody else? When I want something, this is just confessional, when I want something, when I want to buy something, I can make myself the best sounding reasons for it. Right? I need that new phone. I mean, because of the camera, it's great. I'll be able to take, I have a lot of kids. It's great for them. You know, Jesus, you can just stay out of this. When I want something, I'm not greedy. I'm frugal. I'm a great shopper. I'm not materialistic. I just really like nice things. That's why Jesus refers repeatedly to the deceitfulness of wealth. Our money is lying to us. We think our money and the things we can do with it will make us safe and happy and have a better life. But one day, the curtain on all those lies will come up. And that's why Jesus tells this incredibly disturbing story in Luke chapter 16. Let's see if we can understand what this means together. In verse 19, there once was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. Purple was the color of royalty. It was what really wealthy people dressed as. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Now, first thing that would stand out to people who were first hearing this story is this guy is rich. He's really, really rich, but apparently he can afford everything but a name. And Lazarus, the beggar, is named. The Bible does this often. Like in the book of Exodus, it opens up with Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world. And it doesn't even tell you what the name of Pharaoh is. But it tells you the name of the two Hebrew midwives. It's like a different, it's letting us know, the Bible is letting us know, God has a different way of looking at reality. I mean, imagine if you were to hear a news story on Steve the janitor who works alongside the guy who owns Microsoft. Right? It would let you know, like, something's off about this. It's letting us know that God has a different perspective, and it also lets us know that the rich man has a gate. Some of you have been to developing countries, and you know that a gate is a sign of great prosperity. It was then, it is now, it is here. If you own a gate, you can keep people out. Gates serve a purpose. They keep people out. A gate insulates you from people that you don't want around you. The problem with gates is they work two ways. They keep people out, but they also keep people in. I don't think it's just the gates of hell that the church needs to be worried about. I think it's our own gates too. Because in my time in life, some of the most miserable people that I have known are people who use their wealth as a way to insulate and protect them from having to deal with people they didn't want to deal. And what started out as a way to protect them became a prison. The reason we do this is because we want to stay safe. But in my experience, the best way to safety is not by putting up gates. So when I was in Abilene at Highland, there was this guy named Torres. Torres was an ex-convict who was a very big man, the kind of man who could sell shade for a living. He was tatted up, just a huge guy. And Torres became a Christian. He got baptized like 5 years ago. And when that happened, I couldn't do this for everyone, but I did for Torres what I wish I could do for everyone. And Torres and I became tight friends, like really good friends. I did for Torres what I wish I could do for everyone, and that meant giving him rides, loaning him my truck, all kinds of awesome stuff. Torres showed me the city of Abilene in a way that I had never seen it before. And nobody messed with me when Torres was around. One time I went to counseling in this little place, like therapy, in this little area, kind of a nondescript building in the center of town, and my truck was there one day. Didn't say it was a counseling building. My truck was there. It was the only vehicle there. I was in there with my counseling in a session with my counselor, and all of a sudden somebody starts banging on the door. So my counselor's like, hold on, let me go check the door. And he opens the door, and it's Torres going, is Jonathan Storm in here? And my counselor can't legally say anything, right? He was like, I'm sorry, you're going to need to leave. And he's like, Jonathan! Torres starts yelling, Jonathan, you okay? Because Torres was about to wreck shop because he thought I was in trouble in this building somewhere. So finally, I was like, it's okay, Torres, I'm here. I'm doing counseling. We can talk later. And I tell you all that to say, I was never safer in my life than when I had Taurus in my life. Gates would have not served me well there. And notice what it says. It says Lazarus wanted to eat not just food. He wanted to eat with the rich man. He doesn't want to just eat. He wants community. He wants friendship. Just like Jesus is saying earlier in the chapter, use your money to make friends. But the rich man isn't wanting to do that. And then one day the gig is up. In verse 22, the time came, and it always comes, when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called on him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." Jason, can you hand me that water? But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." And he answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." And he said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not even be convinced if someone rises from the dead." A little bit of foreshadowing going on there. Jesus' whole point with this story can be summed up like this. People die the way they live. You reap what you sow. And every day, every moment of your life, you are sowing. And one day we will reap what we have spent our lives doing or not doing. Now, here's one of the things to notice about this story. Jesus is the only person in human history who has come back from the dead. Not resuscitated, but resurrected. Jesus will not die again. He is the only person who has experienced what comes after death. And this is the only time in his ministry that he tells us anything about what to expect. It's not like a historical account, it's a parable, kind of like C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce 2,000 years before he did it. And the first thing to notice in this little story that's disturbing and haunting and it'll keep you up at night, the first thing to notice is so obvious that we miss it. You want to know what it is? When the time comes, the rich man isn't rich anymore. What he has allowed to define himself, his status, his prestige, his purple, is gone. His idols have been destroyed, burned up in the fire. And Abraham reminds him of this. He says, "In your lifetime, you received good things. Lazarus received bad things. You received comfort in your life. And the agony of what was taken away from him is torment." And pay attention what the rich man doesn't ask for. He does not ask to get into heaven. That might be what you'd ask, but that's not what he asked. You know what he asked? For heaven to come to hell. "Send Lazarus, send that beggar that used to be outside my gate, send him down here to serve me. He's in hell because hell is firmly planted in him. He wants Lazarus to come out of heaven and serve him as if that's the way things should be." God has reversed the order, and the rich man does not like the arrangement. He'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. And here's what I want you to see, just because I think it gives you the nature of God and what's coming next. Heaven doesn't call him idiot. Heaven doesn't call him fool. Heaven doesn't call him disappointment. Heaven calls him son. Heaven isn't shut off to this, you know, repentant sinner who's trying to come inside. Heaven doesn't call him son. Or heaven calls him son, but it does not call him rich man. And that chasm, much like a gate, is there to protect Lazarus. Because no longer will the bully rule the playground. No longer will the husband beat his wife. And the words Jesus used here are fascinating. See if this doesn't open up this story for you. The word he uses for in agony is the Greek word odonomai. Let me hear you say odonomai. It means, it's the same word, it can be translated grief or anguish. In fact, it's the same word Luke uses in Luke chapter 2 to talk about what Mary and Joseph felt when they lost Jesus. It's the same word that Luke uses in Acts chapter 20 to describe the Ephesian elders when they're leaving Paul and they realize they're never going to see him again. This is a word that describes grief over losing what you love the most. And here we see what's causing the rich man agony is that he loved the wrong things too much. It's a word that reveals what you love. It's not a word of a physical torture as much as it is emotional grief. It's not so much pain being inflicted from the outside, it's pain being inflicted from the inside. Jesus is not trying to tell you in this story that money is bad and will lead you to hell. No, he's telling a story that already exposes what we know deep down in our hearts. That the worst thing that God can do for you, and this is true almost throughout the Bible, the worst thing God can do for you is give you exactly what you want. Because left to our own devices, we'll create idols for ourselves. We need to worship something. And if you choose to worship money, it will lead to a place of dark despair and a life that is not worth living. One other observation. When it says the Greek man, rich man was tormented, that actually is the word basinos. Can you say basinos? It's a word that meant, it's a Greek word that was like a touchstone. Used for testing jewelry. Because back in the day, people had a lot of jewelry that looked nice on the outside, but you would touch to the touchstone, the basinos, and it would reveal it's not really gold, it's not really silver. Touchstones were needed because stuff looked fancy on the outside, but was fake on the inside. The rich man looks like he's got all his junk together. He's got riches, reputation, and religion, but God knew that on the outside, it was just a facade. And who is Jesus telling this story to? Come on, somebody tell me. Who's he telling this story to? The Pharisees. People who are good at religion and bad at money. The Pharisees, the people who are criticizing him just the chapter before because he's hanging out with all the wrong people. And this story, like the story of the prodigal son before it's like he's the older brother. They both want to keep the poor, ragged brother or neighbor out of sight and out of mind. But Jesus doesn't. And his point in this story, the rich man and Lazarus, is that Jesus and the people who follow him are trying to put into practice in the present world what they believe was coming in the future world. The rich man's life is exposed. Here's the thing. Both of these guys get what they want. When it says the rich man is in the bosom of Abraham, that's a Jewish metaphor for he's with the people of God. He'd always wanted friendship and community, and he got it. And the rich man wanted to be alone and isolated, and he got it. They both got their wish. What they wanted on this earth was granted them in the next life as well. That's what Jesus is trying to say. You know the one time Jesus talks about the final judgment with clarity, like real specific clarity, when he talks about the sheep and the goats, and he says, on the last day, I'll separate them into the sheep and the goats, and I'll say to the sheep, the people who are going into the age to come, into God's good future, I'll say to them, I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. I was hungry and you fed me. And they'll say, when did that happen? And he says, whenever you did this for the least of this, you were doing this for me. Here's what I want you to see about Matthew 25 and what Jesus' judgment is. Jesus isn't doing a magic trick there. He's not turning people into sheep and goats. He's just pulling back the curtain on the deceptions of appearances and revealing reality. In the eyes of the community, the preacher may look like this fine, upstanding member, and maybe they even think they are. But there will be a day when Jesus judges all, and it's revealed. And maybe the preacher or the fine, upstanding church member will find themselves stammering, Lord, when did I not care for you? Because at some point the curtain comes up. The rich man's problem in this story is once he's stripped out of what he's used to make such a big deal out of his life, he's in torment. He doesn't got his purple robe, he doesn't have his money, and he doesn't have his luxury. And heaven loves him, but he doesn't love heaven. He doesn't want to live in a world like that. Because he doesn't want to be the person heaven made him to be. Look at this. Heaven calls him son, but heaven does not call him rich man. You see what's happening here? Jesus is not trying to ruin their life. He's not trying to ruin your life. He's not trying to ruin my life. He's trying to give us a better one. He's trying to let us know, if you love money, if you put your hopes and dreams in money, this is the direction your life and your afterlife is headed. Think of this as the Christmas carol of Ebenezer Scrooge waking up and realizing it doesn't have to be this way. And the joy that comes on Christmas morning when you realize there is a different, a better way, one that leads not to that, but to a life of happiness and joy, a life where my money doesn't have me and my stuff doesn't own me. Jesus is telling you this not because he's trying to scare you, but because he's trying to let you know the way ultimate reality works and give you joy. And you know what? You know when you know this? At funerals. There are two times in life where you hear what a good life is. One you're bombarded with every day. It's commercials. If you just use this shampoo, if you just drive this car, if you would just do this to your house or own this kind of appliance, you would have the good life. Just this weekend, I went to Cindy Sittler's father's funeral. I've done hundreds of funerals. I have never heard anybody say, "Would you talk about what nice hair they had? Would you mention their car? Oh, hey, could you bring up their net worth? Could you bring up how big the square footage of their house is?" And this weekend, as we celebrated a life that was well lived, nobody talked about the toys that were being left behind. What we talked about was the character and virtue and generosity of a man who is passing into the age to come. We know in the funeral what we forget in our daily lives. And that's just this, church. Our stuff is lying to us. The best way to live is not by accumulating more and more, but by being generous and rich toward God. Okay, if you're here today, I'd like to invite the shepherds to take their places in the aisle. If you're here today and you'd like the prayers of anything going on in your life, maybe you would like the prayers for God to open up your eyes in your finances. Or maybe you're anxious about your future. Whatever it is, these godly men would love to pray for you if you would come forward to them while we stand and sing. If you'd like to be baptized, I'll be right down here and a couple of others will too. You can come forward while together we stand.